Thank you, Carolyn. This is Liz Chappell speaking with Carolyn Robinson in Armidale on the... Help me, darling, what's the date?
The date today is the 25th of June.
On the 25th of June, 2019. Carolyn, I'd like to start pretty much at the beginning. I first got to know you as a gardener at Glenrock. Was Glenrock the first garden that you made?
Yes. Yes, it was. I had dallied a little bit when I worked overseas and I worked in the Kimberley, but I really didn't know what I was doing. I put a couple of plants in and that's about it. But even looking back then, I was interested. I wanted to beautify where I was living.
So what was your starting point at Glenrock?
Trees.
Mm-hmm.
Because Glenrock was a very, very bare site. Even though the house had been built in 1892... there was a couple of quite large Nicolais, well, not very large, but, you know, a few metres high. But there was not a tree that was planted dating from that period. There was some big eucalypts just outside at the time, which was outside the garden perimeter. They would have been part of the paddock. But there was certainly no planted trees around the house that dated probably any longer than about 20, 25 years.
When you differentiate between the garden and the paddock, how large was the garden at that point?
Well, the garden fence was about 6 or 7 metres to the north of the house. And the previous owners had... deepened it to the south and to the west, so it wasn't that little, but initially it wouldn't have been much more than 5 or 6 metres right around the house.
So what did you plant first up with your tree selection?
Some willows on the creek because I could do them from cutting. Other than that, a selection of deciduous trees like liquid ambers, pin oaks, claret ash, robinia. Over the first couple of years, as I got to know the species, because at the time I really didn't know what would be suitable to plant.
What was your source of information for that?
Probably the best source was Kath Horn, who was the lady who owned the nursery in Tenterfield at the time, and she certainly sourced a lot of the trees that I planted in the first couple of years. I didn't even start to plant a garden in the first couple of years. All I did was to plant trees around the garden, and one of the first things that Pete did was we fenced the gully into the garden area because it was being heavily eroded by the cattle. Not that I ever considered gardening down there, but there were no trees along that gully whatsoever. And so we just felt it needed that.
Were there books or television programs that influenced you at that point?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly at that time there weren't too many Australian magazines. There was sort of House and Garden and Home Beautiful and a couple of like that. But I must say they didn't give huge amounts of information. Most of the information I got probably was from overseas authors like Penelope Hobhouse and Rosemary Verry and Vita Sackville-West and so forth and so on.
Was part of that because of the New England climate in Australia is not a large part of Australia's gardening area?
Probably, except that probably some of most Australia's most well-known gardens come from mountain areas, don't they, really, whether they be the Southern Highlands or the Blue Mountains or Macedon or... So there has been quite a gardening tradition in the higher country, hasn't there?
Now, as the gardening fancy took hold of you, where did you source plants? Because you amassed a marvellous collection at Glenrock.
Well, a lady called Nola Kieran Armadale, gosh, what was her name?
I shall find out, Carol.
She had a nursery down here, and she sourced quite a lot of plants for me. But probably from 1993 on, I started to collect myself. And I'd drive down to the Blue Mountains and down to Melbourne and the Southern Highlands, etc. And I started to source that large collection myself.
Could you tell us some of the plants that you had at that point that were a little unusual and hard to find?
Certainly quite a lot of the viburnum species. Let me think. Gosh, now you've got me.
Perennials?
Certainly. I didn't probably source as many of the perennials from those journeys. It was mostly shrubby material. The perennials I got from places like Dennis Norgate's,
mm-hmm.
Most of the perennials came through the mail from Tasmania and Victoria.
At what point do you think you developed a vision for Glenrock?
I started to develop it. Well, funnily enough, it started to develop not in Australia, but when Pete and I went travelling overseas. And in 1992, we spent 5 or 6 months in Europe and England doing heaps of gardens, both on the continent and in Britain. And we were staying with friends on Bornholm Island, which is in the Baltic. And our friend had a lovely... She was English, married to a Dane. And she had a lovely, interesting garden, and she would pot plants and take them down to the market. And that's when I started to imagine I could do similarly. And, you know, so the inspiration actually, I can't say, was particularly homegrown. It mm-hmm. came from our travels. And so I came back, and by the end of 93, I'd opened my nursery. So...
Which went in step with the expansion of Glenrock's garden.
Absolutely, and it was nearly all perennials because they were relatively easy for me to propagate. I was doing them by division. I hadn't at that point, didn't have a propagating sort of misting bottom heat system, which I managed later on. And then I started to do more the rarer shrubs as well. And so... Yes, it developed hand in hand. The nursery came first, propagating my own plants, being able to have that material to use in the garden beds. And I suppose it also, I started to read more and more about design, look at design when I was visiting gardens overseas. It's something that sort of developed in tandem. I can't say I sat down and I did never, ever sit down and draw a design for Glenrock. It did grow a bit like Topsy.
And when did you first open it to the public?
I think it was the end of 97.
Mm-hmm. Could you paint a word picture of what it was like then?
Yes. I started... It really was around the house and the terraces to the water, and that's as far as I had gone at that point. I had just finished building the stone wall on the western side down the slope on the western side of mm-hmm. the terraces. I'd started the first stone walls in 95, so it took me 2 or 3 winters to get to that point with the mm-hmm. walls. But at that stage, I hadn't really considered going further, really. Now,
what were some of the challenges you'd struck by that time with your climate and your site?
Probably frost was one of the most significant ones that really determined the kind of plants that I ended up specialising in. It was a frost hollow, so most Australian natives and a lot of otherwise really drought-tolerant plants were excluded. The other thing was the soil. It was pretty poorly drained. I didn't have a huge amount of topsoil, so all the garden beds, in the first instance, I lost a lot from water logging. We had a decent rain event, so I had to build all the beds up. So they were the two most significant problems I had to combat with the site was frost and drainage. Water, I always had a reasonable water supply at Glenrock, so that wasn't a huge problem.
How large was the garden at that point? We started, I think, you know, just a few metres from the house.
I would have thought at that point it would have been maybe 2 acres.
Mm-hmm.
2 acres, probably, a hectare.
Did you have garden help at that point?
I just started to have it at that towards the end of, probably towards the end of 96, I started to have some garden help, because I also started to, I was also doing the nursery and I was starting a little bit helping people outside.
Yes. Now that garden advice arm of your activity has grown a lot. How did it start off?
People would come to the garden and they wanted to buy plants, and I would ask them if they knew what they wanted and where they wanted to put the plants, and a heck of a lot of people hadn't even, they just on impulse decided to come and visit the nursery and not even really consider where they were going to put them. And people started to say, well, could you come and have a look at the garden, please? And in many cases, I was really glad I did, because if they were trying to describe a site that they wanted to plant, they often neglected to say there was a jolly big gum tree in the middle of it, which, of course, would affect the choice of plants that you suggest.
Were you doing formal plans at that stage?
No, I don't. Not really. Mm-hmm. It was just on a garden consultation basis. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget a lady in Deepwater. She'd come out and buy a whole lot of plants, take them back again, and then she'd come back and say, I've lost so many. And I'm thinking, wonder what she's doing. And I said, well, look, she'd come to buy, she'd bought quite a significant number of plants. And I said, well, look, I'll come and help you place them. I just wanted to see what she was doing or not doing, which I did. I placed them and helped her plant them. And I said, and now, where's your water? And she said, oh, the ground's moist enough. She hadn't been watering them in. And it was just an indication to me that you just could not assume that people knew what to do.
Now, about that time, I think you started giving a few talks and lectures with adult education. I'm not sure, was it through TAFE or independent bodies?
No, it was never through TAFE. It was mostly like the Diggers Club or the Women's Club at Glen Innes, places like that. I did quite a few latterly with the Toowoomba Garden Clubs.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going to the Urala. So it was mostly garden clubs, I would think, both on site at Glenrock when bus loads came and being asked to talk at their clubs themselves.
And of course Glenrock was still being developed and extended at that point.
Yes.
Can you describe for us where you went since, I think it was 97, you did the last word picture?
Yes. From there, then I started to go up and down the gully. I had planted trees. I really wanted to do some more perennial plantings, and the gully, particularly on the northern side of the gully, was very, very cold, and was really very suitable for a prairie type planting. So that was the direction I wanted to go. And then, of course, in the early days, we had built a little cottage up the eastern end of the garden, and it just seemed... And we did never have to move the fence because it had been fenced out in the beginning. So it just seemed the garden ought to connect the cottage. So that's how it went. It really went up and down the watercourse, rather than going out into the paddocks.
And what size was this total area that was gardened?
I don't know exactly. It would have been about 6 acres, I suppose.
Yes, that's a formidable amount for one lady to manage on her own.
Well, it wasn't totally on my own. I did usually had somebody once a week, but certainly no more than that. But I did manage a heck of a lot of it on my own.
Now, by this point, you'd developed a great knowledge of gardening in the New England area. Could you share some of those tips with us?
Well, probably just extrapolating from my own experience. Over time, I realised how important soil preparation was, and in most places, drainage was going to be a problem, either because of clay subsoils or ironstone or trap rock or just shallow topsoils. So ripping the soil was terribly important, and in every soil, the addition of organic matter of some kind or another. And it's in all the gardens I have ever done, I have always made that a prerequisite, prerequisite for my doing a garden, that people would be prepared to prepare the ground adequately. And then I knew that they would be happy with the outcome.
Now, you're also a great user of mulch. You've had quite a journey, I think, in deciding different types of mulch.
And still, I still am. I think more than anything, when it comes to large country gardens, it's maintenance of the gardens nearly always becomes an issue, because most people do not have at their fingertips an endless resource of employees or gardeners. And for me, mulch was a tool to manage maintenance, weed control, moisture, evaporation, etc. As much I would have thought it was weed control, which was probably the most important thing in a large area. The choice of mulch is never easy. Organic mulches have drawbacks. Physically, you have to put them on every single year. They stop moisture or a small amount of rain getting through to the soil. But to my mind, it did not negate the importance of weed control, really. At Eagle's Bluff, I have used crushed rock, and one of the biggest benefits is you don't have to reapply it every year. And for a big garden, that's an enormous amount of labour saving. though it's not without its problems, because rock mulch is quite seeds like germinating in them, so they're not totally problem free.
Going back to Glenrock, I think in the early days you were using African lovegrass, Erigostis, yes, which is generally considered somewhat of a pest in farmland, but it was a very effective mulch, a very long-lasting one.
Yes, it was an effective mulch, and the reason I used it is because we had it in our paddocks and we needed to control it. Mm. And by cutting it, it meant that at the start of every spring we had fresh green growth, which was quite palatable. If we hadn't cut it, its non-palatability would have increased every year, and it would have been a huge cattle, would have been a huge problem from a grazing point of view. I mean, it was everywhere in the Tenterfield district. It was ubiquitous. So it was something I could use that we had. It wasn't and isn't the best mulch by any amount of means. It can act quite like a thatch. But it did its job. It didn't allow for dynamic gardening, in that it didn't allow to the same degree self-sown seedlings that are really quite lovely in a naturalistic type garden. But it was just one of those trade-offs I felt I had to make.
Now, the star of the extended garden at Glenrock, I think, were the prairie borders. Where did the influence for those come from?
I would have thought with Europe, reading about Peter Ordoff's work, etc. Although I did start with the use of grasses well before I had read about the naturalistic movement in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I saw their value very early on. I bought my first grasses from the Diggers Club in about 92, and I divided them at the end of the first year, and I put some across on the watercourse, and for the next five years they were there and hadn't required any moisture or anything from me, and they were still fine when I did the prairie garden. So they had demonstrated their sort of viability really in our climate.
Could you summarise how your style of gardening changed over time at Glenrock?
Yes, absolutely. In the beginning, because my knowledge was fairly sparse, I made the mistake of having mixed borders. I mixed trees, shrubs, perennials, and in our rather shallow topsoil, it meant that once the trees became dominant, the perennials and roses didn't fail. They failed. Although there were a couple of things that resulted from that, which was quite fascinating. You know, some of the roses climbed to the top of trees, etc., which one would probably not choose to orchestrate. But it was fantastic anyway. So then I had the problem of planting a woodland garden when the trees were already established, which is not easy when you've got root pack soils. The other big change, I started with herbaceous borders that were hedged, which, when you haven't got a whole battery of gardeners, is not an easy thing to maintain over time, especially tall ones. So the naturalistic prairie-style gardens were probably much better from that point of view, with much lower maintenance, much lower root competition for the perennials. So I think the movement into that more naturalistic prairie style was a very good thing to do, and I've sort of developed and continued that.
Mm-hmm. By about that point, I think it seemed to me you'd developed a recognisable palette of plants that you used. You could walk into a garden somewhere and...
Yes.
We could see that Carolyn had had a hand there. Could you describe that selection to us?
I would think, well, certainly, as far as the grasses are concerned, Miscanthus species, the Panicum species, the Calamagrostis species, Penicetums. I would have thought, as far as perennials are concerned, you've got Pavoscia, the Sedums, the Achilleas, though, I mean, at Glenrock, because I had rabbits, Achilleas were precluded. So now that I've got fencing with no rabbits, it's... So the Achilleas, Tradus Cantia, Echinacea.
And signature shrubs?
Signature shrubs, probably the smokebush, Cotinus, Cornus, Viburnums, Deutzias, Philadelphus. Trees. I do love purple foliage. Berberis. I couldn't be without Berberis. They're so tough. And I do love purple foliage in Australia.
Now, about that time too, I think you were starting to be noticed more broadly. Tricia Dixon wrote about your garden and it appeared in a few other books.
Yes, it has appeared, I think, in most of the major Australian garden magazines over time.
And... was it year 2000 you were voted on House and Garden television program? As
2006.
Right. Could you tell us about that for the tape?
Well, that was fairly exciting. It was House and Garden had decided to do an Australian-wide Garden of the Year viewers selection. So they had selected... well, in fact, I think Better Homes and Gardens had gone to the Open Garden Scheme at the time and asked them for a list of gardens for them to use on the program. And I think they'd... Open Garden Scheme had given them a selection across Australia-wide and they'd knocked it back to about 20... which they decided to go and film, and then they put two per program for 10 weeks or something like that, and it was a viewer's vote, and Glenrock came out on at the end
as the favourite.
As the favourite, yes.
Now, what did that mean to your gardening business?
Well, I don't know whether it... it's hard to know whether or not it actually... I can't recall it being a huge influx of requests for designing or anything because of that. But it may well have.
And about this time, I think... you started developing the garden at Eagle's Bluff.
A bit later than at 2009.
Right. Could you explain to us why you wanted to start afresh and build a new garden?
I guess it's the creating that is so exciting. And at Glenrock, I could not create anymore. It was already... too big, really, for one person. And I still had so many ideas that I'd love to implement and try, and Pete and I had thought of buying some more land just as an investment, and so we were looking. In fact, we'd even actually gone down to Tasmania to look at a change of some land down there, and came back and realised that we didn't really want to go all the way down there. And we just happened to look into the real estate window on our return in 2008, and there was an advert for a rural property on 2 kilometres frontage of the Buff River, and we went down and had a look, and we decided within a week.
So from a gardening point of view, what was it that attracted you to that property?
From a gardening point of view, what attracted me was that there was, and farming, and also from a property point of view, was we really enjoyed, the river was a very pretty little river. Around Glenrock was getting broken up into small lots, so it was becoming much more suburban, and we wanted to be further out of town. That was really quite a big one. I could see it was granite country. I didn't want to be gardening on trap rock. The main part of the garden, in fact, was sited to the south of that site, which appealed, because most of Glenrock's gardens faced upwards to the north, which made it hot and dry in summer. The soil was well drained. There was no love grass. But both of us really liked the site, and it's been a lovely development for both of us, actually. But I think it's because it was partly I had gardened to as far as I could garden at or create at Glenrock. Mm-hmm.
So what were the essential differences in the garden you created at Eagle's Bluff?
I would have thought the biggest difference was the dominance of the landscape, mm-hmm. at Eagle's Bluff, whereas it was at Glenrock it was just a fairly rolling rural scene. So I felt at Glenrock that we really had to produce our own beauty, really, that the garden itself would be the dominant feature in the landscape, whereas at Eagle's Bluff it was never going to be. It was only ever going to be an adjunct to it. Mm-hmm. And so that, it was a very different design from that point of view.
Is it possible to describe it?
Eagle's Bluff.
Yes.
I guess it's very much more informal. Mm-hmm. I've followed the contours. I've been lucky to be able to. I've still been able to use stone as the main landscaping feature, both with stairs and. Stone walls to give me change of level. The garden beds are much larger and deeper, much more probably informally sweeping, with big generous curves. And I've tried to plant with the landscape in mind.
Did that influence your choice of colours as well, with those rolling blue hills in the background?
No, but it certainly it influenced the curves of the bed, the curve of the pool, the pond in front of the house, and the curve of those beds do mirror to some degree the curve of the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
The plantings were probably influenced largely by either enhancing or not blocking or blocking views.
Now, initially you were reluctant to open Eagle's Bluff. Was it designed more as a private garden for you and Peter?
Yes, yes. And funnily enough, it's one of the things that probably instigated our move from Glenrock, having the garden open all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was something I found quite stressful.
Of course, paradoxically, I think it's Eagle's Bluff that has brought you so much more national attention.
Yes.
Can you tell us about, and I do apologise for not having done my homework and having these dates to hand, but the State Library of New South Wales had an exhibition that you were a part of?
Yes, that was the planting design. What was it called?
I can look that up.
Yeah, oh, gosh, it's escaped me. Planting Dreams exhibition.
Right, and that was 2014?
Oh, I think it was 16, wasn't it? Yes, I think it was 16.
Now, you were displayed there along with some of the best-known names in Australian gardening and garden design. Could you reel off some of those for us for the tape? That's very unfair, isn't it? I should have done that.
Now I've had a mental blank. We'll have to.
No, I should have done my homework.
No, I've absolutely.
But
had
it was a splendid display.
Yes, yes, it was. But it was mostly New South Wales, and it was designers and also their own gardens. And I think it was probably the change in design and planting design may well have had something to do with it. Glenrock was very much, I started from scratch, and the paradigm that I followed at that point was the English one. And with time and knowledge, and my knowledge of plants, etc., I started to develop my own style, which, of course, I have implemented it at Eagle's Bluff. So I can probably understand why that has occurred at Eagle's Bluff, because it's not a repetition of something you see everywhere, probably. I don't know.
And also in Claire Takis's book, last year, before, which was called, help me, I haven't got it.
Australian Dreamscapes.
That's right, I knew it had dreams in it.
Yes.
Eagle's Bluff featured very prominently there. Could you tell us a little bit more about the experience of working with Claire and that book?
Yes, it was a lovely experience. Claire found out about me, I think, through the Plant Hunter, and she rang me and asked whether she could come up to Eagle's Bluff to have a look. She was seeking out gardeners that were planting in a sort of free-form, naturalistic type style for her forthcoming book, Australian Dreamscapes. She had already published a book called Dreamscapes, which had done that on a world basis. And she came up to Eagle's Bluff twice. Luckily, it wasn't the last year. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been photos. So she came up at the end of December 17 and March 18. And she was lovely to work with. She stayed with us both times, and she was very, very fleet on her feet, going from, because she did most of her filming in an hour, just after dawn, and an hour before dusk. It was incredibly constricted time for me. And she seems to shoot most of her photographs into the sun.
Yes, that contrajura, whatever they call
yes,
it. Yeah,
yeah. Which from a photography point of view, used to be a no-no.
I know, a real challenge.
Yes, absolutely.
But for gardens, it can be
splendid, especially with ornamental grasses.
Yes, now you have designed a great number of gardens around the New England. Could you hazard a guess at how many?
Oh, gosh, well, I don't know, 20 or 30 or probably more. I mean, there haven't been so many that I've done right from scratch, and I've been involved with the whole process. I've helped people do bits and bobs and get them started, etc. And it's only over the last decade that I've started to do larger ones from scratch. And but even over the last decade, you realise how ephemeral gardens are, because with drought and changing ownership and people becoming unwell, you just realise how gardens are not timeless by any amount of means.
Do you think we'll see a gardening tradition where we have enduring gardens the way they do in England that are visited generation after generation?
I would be surprised, purely because of our climate. It is so harsh. And it's hard to keep gardens going from decade to decade. I mean, you can see that yourself.
Indeed.
And, I mean, I haven't been back to Glenrock, but it will have changed a heck of a lot. The trees will endure, but the gardens won't, I don't think.
Can you describe some of your favourites amongst the gardens that you've designed, particularly those where you've had a free hand with the landscape?
Probably. I loved the gardens out at Wiltshire, out at Inverell. I enjoyed doing those. I loved working with people like Patsy and Don Sterling at the Bramble Patch. And early on, one of the gardens I enjoyed doing most was the Stanthorpe Garden of
Wurrunga.
Yes. Dennis and Rosalind Lincoln, and then Lanice Thirkel. That was one I enjoyed doing a lot. But partly it's because I was working with the owners, and they were actually very actively involved in the gardening process. And I've just found over time that they are the ones that tend to endure more than those that rely on employees or gardeners to do it.
Could you summarise then some of the advice you would give to gardeners in the New England climate?
Well, certainly find out exactly what your climate is like. Get local knowledge as far as the plants that are most suitable, because even within the New England there are microclimates, some of which are easier to garden on than others. The soil types vary considerably, but always think about water, inclusion of organic matter in your garden beds, and probably get some design advice in the first instance. I wish I had.
Does that extend to actually writing a formal or drawing a formal plan?
Not necessarily. not necessarily. Most people find it very difficult if they have a blank slate. The placement of trees, where to put garden beds, where to put particular features. Even some people just need some on-the-ground pointers, really, because at the end of the day, a lot of people want it to be instrumental in making their own garden. So it's just sometimes pointers can be helpful without having to do full garden plans.
Now, we've spoken very little about Australian native plants, but they certainly have a place in your landscape at Eagles Bluff.
Very, very much so. It was one of the things that I regretted at Glenrock was that the cold prevented me growing very many Australian native plants. The soils, the well-drained soils, well-drained granite soils, the fact that it's hotter and less cold in the winter, though there are significant frosts, means that I have been able to experiment with Australian natives. But by and large, I don't, with the exception of a grevillea border, most of my native plants are mixed with exotics. I don't purposefully grow them separately. And I think that's probably one of the best ways to grow them. I feel that Australian natives benefit with being grown with other plants that require similar conditions. I think it allows a greater diversity of use of colour, foliage colour and textures and form. I think a lot of people find an exclusively Australian native garden, particularly cold hardy Australian native plants, don't have a huge variation in texture or form. So you get a garden that appears to be visually not particularly interesting. By including other plants from other climates that are similar, for example, North American deserts or South African plants or Mediterranean plants, you get a much more varied textural look in the garden. The other thing is that the drought that we have just had has demonstrated that Australian native plants, by and large, are not significantly more hardy than our tried and tested garden plants that have been around for many, many years. And maybe it's because they're short-lived anyway, particularly plants like grevilleas, Miramophilas, that at the towards the end of a decade they're probably pushing their lifespan anyway, and the added insult of either frost or drought means they turn up their toes and rely on self-seeding to propagate themselves. So it's really a fallacy that they're low maintenance from that point of view. But there are many, many exotic plants that are more drought hardy.
Where to next for Eagles Bluff? Is the garden ever really finished, Carolyn?
Well, I'm getting to the point where I can see absolutely the fence is not going out. But there will always be improvements and changes, and I can see it developing for a little while yet. I'm still building stone walls, for example, and I'm definitely extending or I'm developing my prairie style gardens, which I love. They are definitely my favourites, the perennial borders. And that's my first love, absolutely.
Now, is there any gardening ground we haven't covered in this discussion that you would like to share?
I don't think so. We've touched on most things, I think.
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn.